Hello, my name's Henry Goldstein from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This talk was recorded live at DFTB 17. The wheels are in motion for our next edition, and you can find out more at dftb18.com. Enjoy.
Thanks very much, Damien. I promised Gerb that I'd get in touch with Damien, so I might have to let him know that I have. It took 7 years, literally, but anyway, I'm here. And I just want to say thanks to Don't Forget the Bubbles for the opportunity to be here. It's really great to be here, and I'm really grateful for it. I love Brisbane. Brisbane's where I was born, so being in Brisbane's great. I love getting to talk, so getting to talk is good. Do you need me to talk for longer? It sounded like you needed me to talk for longer. Anyway, get comfortable, because once I get started, I could be here for a while. And I love experiencing new things. And there is so much about this conference that is new for me, actually. I've never sat on a couch in a conference before. I've never heard a 10-year-old speak at a medical conference before. I think that was terrific. Thank you, Conrad. It was really great to hear that. I've never felt so comfortable to be sitting there checking my emails in the middle of somebody else's talk. It's amazing. I mean, it looks like I'm tweeting, doesn't it? So that's perfectly acceptable. I've never had so many wardrobe suggestions for speaking at a conference. Like, I'm very accustomed to people telling me to cut my hair before I talk at a conference, but telling me what I should wear doesn't happen so much. Where's Ben Lawton? He tried to give me a shirt. Sorry, mate. I will wear it proudly in Darwin as a mowing shirt on a Saturday afternoon. It'll be, and maybe not just there, but it's a good shirt. Sorry, I didn't wear it. There's a good mate in Darwin who wanted me to make sure I tucked in my shirt so I didn't look too scruffy like I was from Darwin. I don't think I've succeeded there. Liz Crow, a good friend, really wanted me to stand up here. She heard 2 or 3 weeks ago about the title of this talk, which has a slight risk of sounding pretentious. And she wanted me to turn up with a cape on because I think she was quite convinced that there was no way that we could save the world without somebody in a cape. Anyway, sorry to disappoint you as well, Liz. And I guess the reason why I haven't turned up in a cape is because I don't think it would suit me. I haven't even managed to get my hair cut or tuck in my shirt. But the other reason is that I am actually here genuinely saying to you, I think we can. I think we can change the world. I'm with this guy, Paul Farmer, who wrote the speeches that are contained in this book. And if you don't want to listen to me, this is a book I've been reading lately. I'd encourage you to get a hold of it and read it and think about it. It's an infectious diseases physician in the States who has done some amazing work in Haiti and other places around the world, started an organization called Partners in Health, and really tries to sort of lift our eyes a bit from the stuff that we worry about, the stuff that seems to consume our lives, to say, well, what else is going on and what can we do? And so I would say to you, I think we can change the world, but then I would ask you the question, do we need to? Does the world need to change? We're in a pretty comfortable spot right here. I'm sitting here checking my emails, listening to a good talk, the fancy lights on the stage, had 3 pieces of cake for morning tea this morning. Thanks. And so it's pretty good life, isn't it? Does the world need to change? Who reckons the world needs to change? I mean, I want to say to you, for this kid, the world needs to change, doesn't it? I mean, he's one example, and maybe I could show you others. Maybe I could show you a picture of some of the incredibly oppressive and difficult refugee camps that people live in, or the detention centers that our own country runs, or I could show you other pictures of people facing incredible suffering. I mean, I choose this one because he's close to me. It means a lot to me. This is an 8-year-old whose cryptococcal meningitis took 4 months to diagnose because of the poor access to healthcare where he was living, and the fact that when he would go for healthcare, there was no one with any real capacity to make a diagnosis, or having made a diagnosis or even suspected it, to be able to investigate it further or to manage it appropriately. No access even once a diagnosis is made, and there's this clinical suspicion and this evidence of papilledema and the severely raised intracranial pressure to do a CT scan or something that would enable you to take the next step to do a lumbar puncture to reduce some of the intracranial pressure that he was suffering from. For this boy, and he's happy for his photo to be shown, and his parents are as well. And he's happy even for his name to be told, and so I'll use it. As I said, it means a lot to me, this kid. His name's Pharrell. And for Pharrell, the world needs to change, doesn't it? I mean, I really believe it does. And do you know, there's a lot about Ferrell's case that for me is very affecting. It's very confronting and very difficult. I mean, I have had this boy in front of me very close to death on a number of occasions. But one of the really confronting things for me is where this kid lives. So this kid comes from a town that if you were to fly there directly as the crow flies, would take you less than an hour to get there. It took me 3.5 to get to Brisbane from Darwin. And this is a boy who lives really as a neighbour of ours. He lives in a small community in the south of the island of Timor, in the part of Timor people call East Timor, Timor-Leste. This is a kid who's our neighbour. And for this boy, I want to say to you, the world needs to change. And so I've got this opportunity to talk to you this afternoon a little bit about pediatrics in Timor. I'm not just going to tell you about Ferrell, but I guess to give you a picture of what things look like for this neighbour of ours. Some of you will have been to Timor-Leste, many of you will have not. For some of you, you might be similar to how I was before I visited there for the first time, or my Uber driver yesterday. To be honest, no idea about the country and no idea about what they've been through and what their history is. And I haven't got the time this afternoon to tell you the story, but I'd encourage you to look at it, especially if it sort of hits you this afternoon that they're right there. They're an hour's flight from Darwin. These are our neighbours. But I'll tell you some of the things that are happening even now as we speak. Timor-Leste has the highest rate of stunting in children under 5 in the world. And up to 60% of the children under 5 are moderately or severely stunted. Nearly half of the children under 5 are moderately or severely underweight. Ferrell, when he turned up to hospital at 8 years of age, after 3 months of chronic headaches and vomiting and weight loss, weighed 15 kilos. It's incredible. And almost impossible to get your head around, actually. And so this is a country right on our doorstep where children are suffering. And the malnutrition is one example of it. And again, I could go into lots of details with lots of different examples. This is a study that was published by an Australian pediatrician working in Dili and Timor-Leste, Ingrid Buessens, at the moment. And this was a study where they looked at 3 years of morbidity and mortality in the National Hospital in Timor. So this is within Dili, the capital city, where the access to healthcare is the best that it is in the country, where you really have reached the end of the line in terms of what the country can offer. And the in-hospital mortality rate, case fatality rate for children who get admitted over those 3 years was 6% from a range of different diseases. And I mean, I can throw numbers at you like that. Sometimes I don't know how to communicate it to make it come home and be real. Probably one of the most confronting things is just to go and sit in a mortality and morbidity meeting. They have them once a month, and you sit in a meeting, and for a month's worth of admissions, you'll talk about 15 children who died. And I mean, trust me, it's exhausting, it's confronting, it's terrible. And there's the children who died from diarrhea, and the ones who died from pneumonia, and the ones who died from TB, and the ones who died from sepsis. And this isn't including the neonatal deaths, which gets covered in another meeting. And as confronting as those mortality meetings are, you sort of reach this extra level then when you have this child there in front of you. And you think this child with gastroenteritis, with a potassium of who knows what because the labs run out of potassium reagent, is going to die if I don't do something and I don't even know what I should do. And the gastroenteritis deaths are dreadful, and it's confronting and it's awful, and it hits you hard and you think this is so outrageous and so wrong. Some of you yesterday would have heard me talk a little bit about rheumatic heart disease. And instead of a 9-month-old with diarrhea, you end up with an 11-year-old, a 12-year-old, somebody who's already beginning to see their life ahead of them and going to school and learning a bit of English as well as their tetun, and they're excited about the future, and they come into hospital with dyspnea because of their heart failure and find themselves in a position where they cannot be treated for this completely preventable condition. And for me, some of those children who have died in their teenage years are the ones that will never, ever leave me. And I'm sorry to sort of bring such a sober note to what has been such a positive and uplifting conference, but this has to change, doesn't it? I mean, this is on our doorstep. These are children who live an hour from where my 4 children live, and yet with none of the opportunity, none of the access to care that mine would have. So, I mean, what do we do? How do you change this? How do you change this? I got given this sort of topic of we can change the world. Let me start with Timor. And I suppose to give you a bit of a glimpse of some of the exciting and encouraging stuff that I've been able to be involved with in Timor, with an increasing engagement between Royal Darwin Hospital and health services in Timor, to try to make some sort of a difference in this place. And one of the things that you have to think when you start hearing these sort of problems and you start looking at papers like Ingrid's and you look at the problem of rheumatic heart disease and you look at the problems of TB and malnutrition is this is a big problem, needs a big solution. And where are the public health people? Now, the public health infrastructure in Timor is very limited, but the idea of looking for public health solutions to some of these big problems is obviously very compelling and something that's really important. But I want to say to you, and I'm going to only focus on public health solutions relatively briefly, because I think there is a trap there. You can look at this big problem and think a big solution. What are we going to do? And it's very easy to sort of get run off down tracks that are perhaps not all that useful. I remember, like, honestly, I didn't know what to do with this going over to Timor one September. Did anyone know it's the World Rabies Day on the 28th of September? No. I'm in the wrong crowd, obviously, aren't I? It is. It's World Rabies Day on the 28th of September. It's World Rabies Day every 28th of September. And rabies is a huge public health problem worldwide. Very important thing to discuss and a really important thing to combat from a public health point of view. But to have a massive funded event for World Rabies Day in Dili, in Timor-Leste, bring speakers and people and shirts and posters. And I mean, without spending too much time talking about rabies, there's never been a reported case of rabies in East Timor. And I look at this and I think, what on earth are we doing? We are surrounded by children who are dying with diarrhea and pneumonia and TB and rheumatic heart disease and malnutrition, and we're talking about rabies one day only. But I guess I want to make the point that if you're thinking public health solutions, it's got to be connected, it's got to be linked in, it's got to be focused on what the actual issues are. I probably don't need to tell this crowd that antibiotic resistance is a massive problem worldwide. In fact, many of you are pediatric emergency people, and so you're used to prescribing antibiotics. And again, sorry to single out Ben Lawton, but I'm sure it was Ben who told me the motto of pediatric ED. You must know it, isn't it? Every player gets a prize. That was you. It had to be you. And so I'm not meant to be talking about what you do in your pediatric emergencies, but just don't make the prize azithromycin every time, please. It doesn't need to be. Antibiotic resistance is a massive problem worldwide. And it's something that deserves a public health approach. And it certainly has had a public health look at it from a Timor point of view. So you get these great signs in English and in Tetun making the point about using antibiotics wisely. Now, for all the signs and posters, it's not quite enough. This, to me, isn't a public health response. A public health response says, what is the problem and what are we actually going to do about it? And we've had a really good opportunity over the last 12 months, supported by the World Health Organization and working with our lab in Darwin, as well as with the National Laboratory in Timor and with the National Hospital, to develop for the first time an antibiogram, an idea of what the antibiotic resistance rates are like in Timor. This stuff wasn't known previously. And it's given us a really good opportunity to think really carefully and critically about how do you use antibiotics in Timor? How do you, from a public health point of view, take a sensible approach to empiric antibiotic guidelines in a place that doesn't have access to regular microbiology, where you can't get a blood culture, where you can't get a CSF culture, where if you are lucky enough to get a wound swab that gets cultured, you won't get any drug sensitivities. And so we've done this antibiogram. We've found startlingly high rates of resistance, particularly amongst gram-negatives. And dealing with this as a public health problem is something that's really crucial in a country like Timor. And it's something that has really given us an opportunity to apply some practical, sensible research questions to a place that desperately needs that. And so, as a second point, if you like, of how do you go about changing a place like Timor? How do you look at these bigger problems around the world and address them? Public health solutions need to be driven by asking the right questions and saying, how are we going to prioritise? How are we going to put in some sort of an order the things that we'll address in a place like Timor? And there's been some work done on that. This was a really nice paper that was published a few years ago now, looking at some of the research priorities for a country like Timor-Leste. And this is a bit of a doctored version. I'm sorry, this is the one that comes into my slide because I looked through it everywhere for rheumatic heart disease and couldn't find it anywhere. And the stuff that I was talking about yesterday, for those of you who came, with some of the highest rates of rheumatic heart disease in the world in Timor-Leste will published this year and hopefully be able to start to prompt some of that public health response by starting to understand at least the problem that we're dealing with. And so I want to say to you, and again, without dwelling on it long because we don't have time, that asking research questions has to be part of the thinking, because you go into these situations and you just sort of keep doing the same thing day after day after day after day, and you don't start to change the things that are going on. And so I'd encourage you, whether you're a pediatrician, emergency physician, surgeon, whoever you are, ask these questions, look at what you're doing and say, are we doing the right thing? Do we even know what we're dealing with? Is there some basic epidemiological question we should be asking in this place if we really want to make a difference? Is there some sort of more finessed question that we can ask about, well, how do we deal with this? How do you manage mild rheumatic heart disease in a place like Timor? And is there a role for a clinical trial to make some sort of a long-term impact on many people by answering some of these research questions? There is definitely a role for this. But I want to sort of get to the end of my opportunity to talk this afternoon by telling you what really drives me. And this is where I see an opportunity to make a difference in my work in the Northern Territory, to make a difference in a place like this even, to make a difference, I hope, in a place like Timor-Leste. And that is by investing not in public health posters, not even necessarily just in antibiotic guidelines, not in big funded research programs. To me, the investment that makes a real difference is investing in people. And I want to tell you about some of the people that we're looking to invest in. And these relationships that have built up over the last 4 or 5 years for me now are incredibly precious and meaningful and so rewarding for me, but also so exciting in terms of the impact that we start to see it have. I showed a picture of this young fellow yesterday, and his name's Anari. He has completed high school and he's at the moment doing some extra study at night time to get a degree in public health through the National University in Timor. But he's coordinating the very first rheumatic heart disease register for the delivery of secondary prevention for children with rheumatic heart disease in Timor-Leste. And Anari has gotten a hold of this like you wouldn't believe. He knows more about rheumatic heart disease than anybody in Timor. He's wearing a shirt that says Puan Diak, which literally means good heart. It also can mean good fruit, but he goes with a cardiology program, so people know that he's talking about good heart. And actually, he's got a beautiful way of describing the impact of rheumatic heart disease families as he explains to them that this little bug, this strep bug, is getting in and eating away at the heart. So the fruit sort of metaphor works a little bit. But you know, this guy is delivering penicillin to children in the mountains of Timor-Leste and is achieving better rates of adherence to benzathine penicillin for children with rheumatic heart disease than we have been able to achieve in the Northern Territory. And the impact of investing in him and seeing the ripple effect of that as he invests in the communities. This guy goes along with benzathine penicillin injections, and if any of you have had it or given it, it's a horrific experience. And literally he hops out of the troopy and the kids are hanging off his arms like he's the Pied Piper, and he's walking through and I think, are you about to stick a needle in these kids' bum? But they all love him. And it's this personal, real engagement that he has with them and with their families as he explains what's going on. And the success of this program for me is something that is incredibly exciting. I don't have long left to talk, but I do want to tell you about some other exciting things to do. And for me, this is something that has been incredibly thrilling. We've seen it develop over a number of years. I would love somebody to hazard a guess how many Timorese pediatricians there are in Timor-Leste for a country of close to 1.5 million people, where half of the country are aged under 17. Somebody can try. So there was a 10, there was a 0, Liz is trying to be cheeky. The 3. Three Timorese pediatricians in that country with more than 500,000 children with high rates of child infant mortality. I mean, it's quite a shocking number to me. But there is some excellent work going on in terms of training pediatricians, and you'll see pictures on here of a number of the trainees, the pediatric registrars who are working in the National Hospital. And there's a program that's being funded by the Australian government, led by Professor David Brewster, who's an Australian pediatrician who's there in Timor, training a cohort of Timorese pediatricians. There are about 12 registrars in the program at the moment. And we've been able to establish an exchange program, which has seen Timorese pediatric registrars come and work with us in Darwin, attend some conferences, have been very well supported, not just by me, but by the whole team in Darwin. You see a few members of the team there. But also, as part of that program, sending pediatric registrars from Royal Darwin Hospital across to Timor and working with the Timorese registrars in the National Hospital there. And it's been a really exciting way of investing in people, of not just investing in some program, and it's a great program, but it's actually getting alongside these people and seeing them start to change and start to learn and start to grow. And these are the pediatricians who will have an impact on Timor into the future, something I'm incredibly excited about. And so with the couple of minutes left to me, let me come back to Pharrell. This is the same boy that I showed you at the beginning, which is hard to believe when you look at his smiling face there with his mum and Melinda in the background. And this is an incredible story of what you would say is actually quite a lucky boy for a place like Timor-Leste. He was funded by ROMAC, which is an arm of Rotary, and had the opportunity to come across to Darwin. And in Darwin, he had multiple neurosurgical procedures. He had a prolonged course of antifungal therapy. He had at least three occasions where he was incredibly close to death and yet survived, and is now back home with his family in Anaro. I was able to visit him with my six-year-old recently and have a beautiful, very celebratory lunch with them in their house in Anaro, at which point he told me that he'd stopped taking his fluconazole 3 days before, so it was quite a timely visit, but he's back on it now, which is good. I love this kid, I love his family, and I love the opportunity that we had to invest in them. And for me, this here is a huge privilege that we have in clinical medicine. I know that for many of you, you're clinicians and you come face to face with patients like Conrad, like Pharrell, and the privilege that we have to get involved with and to invest in the life of a kid like this for me is phenomenal. But I want to say to you that there's a huge power in this as well. Because if you look at a kid like Pharrell, and you look back at these sort of suggestions about how you maybe change the world, or at least try and change a place like Timor-Leste, or maybe change the department you work in, or change a place like the top end of Australia, it's easy to think, well, what are you achieving by fundraising for and bringing across this one Timorese kid? How does that fit with the many who die of preventable things? And how is this even the right thing to do? It's actually can be pretty confronting when you start tying yourself in knots and asking these sorts of questions. I mean, this isn't much of a public health intervention, is it? Bringing Pharrell across and saving his life. It's not like any research that we do on cryptococcal meningitis in Timor-Leste is going to make any difference for him. I mean, where does this fit in the overall scheme of trying to change things in Timor? And I guess what I would say to you, and if I can take a moment just to make this final point, I genuinely believe that unless we are prepared to invest in those who are right there in front of us, to do something for the ones who need something, who are there in front of us with an opportunity for us to invest, I don't think we have any hope of changing the world. I don't think we have any hope of dreaming up some marvelous public health intervention that's going to magically save or change the world if we are not prepared to give of ourselves enough for the ones who are right there in front of us. And I would love to finish with just one more story. Can I finish with one more story? Yeah, thanks. And it's an old story. And probably when people invited me to come here and speak, if I said to them that I was going to tell you a story from the Bible, they might have said, no, wrong conference. Sorry, you shouldn't come. But I want to, because to me, this is a story that tells a lot. And it's a story that Jesus told 2,000 years ago when he'd said to a crowd of people, you've got to love your neighbor. And somebody said, some smart ass obviously, said, who's my neighbor though? And we could ask that here in Australia, who's my neighbor? Who are you talking about when you say help the people right there in front of you? Who is my neighbor? And he went on to tell this story, and the story involves a guy who gets beaten up and left on the side of the road, and he's left for dead, and nobody's going to look after him. No emergency physicians, obviously, anywhere to be seen. And he's half dead on the side of the road, and a couple of really important people just walk right on past him. Now, as I hear the story, I sort of think important people, important things to do, like they're probably thinking of the greater good, you know. What, I haven't got time to help this kid. I haven't got time to help this guy. I've got many others to feed. I've got many others to serve. I've got so much else to do. I'm busy. I'm important. I've got lots of other things to do. This one will just need to leave. And the story finishes beautifully with a Samaritan guy, who meant nothing to anybody really, who stopped and showed care and attention. And the point of the story is to say, this is love. This is making a difference. This is actually where it's at. And I would say to you that unless we are willing to be like that, to say, all right, this one's here in front of me, I'm going to invest in them, Inari's here and he's ready to go with rheumatic heart disease. I'm going to invest in him. Pharrell's here and wait a second, I can do something for this kid and we can get him across to Darwin and we can save his life. And without that sort of motivation, without that sort of desire to help the ones who are right in front of us, I think the bigger dreams, the bigger plans, that massive idea of saying, how can I change or repair or save the world, I think is this pipe dream that we never quite get to. And so let me finish with that last point, investing in people. For me, that's where it's at. And thanks for the opportunity to talk about it.
So who wants to change their commitment to We Can Change the World? We have a few questions, I think.
Yes. First question. Are there any opportunities for those doctors and paramedical staff outside of Darwin Hospital to work in Timor-Leste?
Yeah, that's a great question to ask, actually. And I will just say yes. I mean, it's almost a qualified yes. I don't usually give a qualified yes to that. My email address was on there. Let me know if you're interested. Whoever that person is, put them in touch with me. The reality is that there is so much need in Timor-Leste that if you are genuinely interested in getting invested and committing to making a difference there, the opportunities are endless. So I would say a confident yes to it. And the only qualification is that it's blooming hard. Like it's a hard slog and it's a hard place to make a difference without having a presence there. So it is a reality that there are opportunities, and there are opportunities across those spheres. I mean, there are definitely opportunities from a research point of view. There are so many unanswered questions in the place. There are opportunities to get involved from a public health and from a capacity building point of view, and there are certainly opportunities to get alongside mentoring people and making a difference in sort of clinical spheres. But cracking into those opportunities can be difficult, and I'd love to hear from whoever it is who asked the question.
Thanks. Our next question from Aidan Barron. Paul Farmer started Zamni La Santé before medical aid was in vogue. How do we ensure that aid programs are ethical?
That's a tough question. How do we ensure our medical aid programs are ethical? I take that on board for myself rather than feeling like I'm qualified to judge somebody else's medical aid program, to be honest. And I think that there is a risk when you question the ethics of medical aid programs of resigning yourself to doing nothing, which is a tragedy and a loss. And so there is the potential to be so caught up with wondering if this is the right thing to do that you end up not really doing anything at all. And that's not a reason or an excuse to go on with your cape on and sort of scoot into a country thinking you're going to turn the place on its head and save it. I think, to be honest, maybe if I came back to one simple answer, it's to be humble about what you think you can achieve. And be prepared to learn even as you get alongside people.
Thanks. Then one last question. How can busy clinicians who can't practically come to Timor-Leste and work, how can they support and engage and help work in other locations that need help from home?
So again, thanks for the question. I mean, the questions are terrific. And there are lots of different ways that you can. And maybe this is where the question around ethical aid organisations really comes in. Because if people are going to invest some money, which is how I'm going to get to answering this question a little bit, you want to know that it's going to somewhere that's making a difference. And I mean, to take Timor-Leste as an example, the health spending, so the national health spending per annum is around 60 million a year. And I told you the population's close to 1.5 million people. So basically $50 or $60 a year spent per person on people for health in Timor. And it literally is not enough. And so there are organisations doing some really good work in Timor. And again, if people want to get in touch with me, I'm happy to direct them. If you specifically want to give to things that are genuinely useful and making a difference in Timor, that's certainly one possibility. And I guess the other thing, and again, it's a matter of finding your way into a relationship that makes this possible. But a lot of my support for Timor happens with regular visits, but it's also stuff that happens through WhatsApp on a daily basis. And so the opportunity to get alongside people and to mentor them and to be an ear for them when they need to get something off their chest is something that's also very real, but does require a relationship to make it work.
Thanks.
Excellent. Conrad, you've just been exposed to something I wasn't just been mulling over what you've just listened to and heard. Do you have any comments back to us about some of the other presentations? You might not do.
No pressure.
Did you want to talk about the your school's charity for Timor?
Oh yeah, we have a school charity at the moment. It's called CAF Cambodia. Mm. It's like East Timor, where it's a very poor country, and they don't have a lot of medical things, and lots of the children don't have education, and our school focuses on education for them.
That's truly awesome. I love it. And Conrad, there's a story I wanted to tell you after, and I'm going to take the chance to tell it now so I can hear it too, because I think it's awesome. And Damien went quiet for like it was maybe 2 seconds, and it was long enough for me to jump in. Because, you know, as you and your mum were telling that story, it made me think of a girl who we found quite coincidentally last year, a day after the Dili Marathon, and she'd been running in the fun run for the Dili Marathon, and had gotten a bit short of breath, and so had stopped, but obviously quite sporty, quite like yourself. And the next day she had an echocardiogram with the team that we had over of Australian cardiologists volunteering with East Timor Hearts Fund, and found a subaortic stenosis, very similar. And it's amazing to think of a child just like you in Timor, very much the same condition.
Fantastic. So that's very humbling. A round of applause for all the speakers, please.